Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to another cracking Empire Podcast interview special. Get Carter is one of the greatest British movies of all time. It's a relentlessly bleak crime thriller in which Michael Caine's gangster goes back from London to his old hometown of Newcastle. Thankfully, he doesn't even attempt the accent. And well, he doesn't exactly right some wrongs. He wrongs some wrongs. And along the way, there are some of the most iconic images and lines of the last 51 years. The movie came out in 1971, would you believe? There's Caine at his coolest and most cold-blooded, whether he's wielding a shotgun in the nude, having phone sex with Britt Eklund, or throwing Alf Roberts off of Coronation Street off the top of a multi-story car park. And there are lines of dialogue that you have almost certainly misquoted at some point in your life. It is an absolute belter, made all the more impressive for being Mike Hodges' directorial debut on the big screen. That is, Hodges had written and directed two TV movies, Rumour and Suspect, before making the step up by adapting Ted Lewis's hard-bitten crime novel, Jack's Return Home. It was a quick turnaround as well. Get Carter came out almost exactly a year to the day after Jack's Return Home was first published in 1970. Yet the quality didn't suffer, as you can see in this brand new 4K restoration that the BFI has just re-released in cinemas and which will hit home entertainment in July. Hodges, like his star Michael Caine, is still going strong. He's 89 now and he recently took time out to talk to me for the Empire podcast. We talked about Get Carter, of course, and we also touched on his eclectic career, which has seen him direct the likes of Pulp, another Michael Caine starrer, Flash Gordon, Morons from Outer Space, Black Rainbow, and Croupier. He talked about some of those and that career and things like his ill-fated attempt to direct Damien, Omen 2, with great candor and insight, and I loved chatting to him. Hope you guys do too. Here is Mike Hodges. Do please enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by the director of Get Carter, which has been re-released, restored, remastered in glorious 4K. It is the great Mike Hodges. How are you, sir?
I'm old. That covers everything. You can interpret it whichever way you like.
It's a hell of a thing to be talking about Get Carter almost 50 years after... After it's come out. It is, I think, Mike, probably the most misquoted film of all time.
In what way?
And I think people just get things wrong. They remember things. You could say quoting Get Carter is a full-time job. And with, that's a misquote, for example.
No, I agree. Yeah, you're right. It's interesting that these phrases slipped out and became moved into the general language, the general way that people were communicated. It's very interesting, I suppose. That's sort of a compliment, I suppose, to have all of those quotes in a thin glass. And, people used to shout at me with all these things every time they knew I was, in a thin glass, or you're a big man, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, at the time, I thought, this is okay, fine. I'm flattered, but looking back, it's pretty odd, actually.
And how much of that came from you, and how much of it came from Ted Lewis, who wrote the original book?
Well, it varies. Piss Holes in the Snow, it's very difficult. I haven't read the book for ages, but I can only say that it'd be certainly 50-50. And if not more intense court than mine.
Is this something that over the years you became aware of? Because the film comes out in 1971, and if I'm right in thinking, does well, it's well received at the time. But was there a moment when you began to realize that you had made something that had a cultural footprint as well?
Yes, it's weird. So there were two things, actually. Anthony Frewin, who's a name you may not know, but he was Kubrick's sort of side, his right-hand man for many years. He was a novelist as well as everything else. He's a very talented man. And he wrote a novel which started with someone running a video of Get Carter. And that's the beginning of the book. And then I was in New York some years later. And I was in a restaurant, a very famous one, like the name I can't remember. Mm-hmm. It was owned by an Englishman. And when he found out that I'd done Get Carter, he went absolutely apeshit. I mean, he was just so excited. And I realized then that until then, I didn't really know, you know, that it had this underswell of people who loved the film. I just didn't know it. And it disappeared as quickly as it arrived in many ways. And then I think also I kept being told that Ted, what was it called? He had this television channel, the first one that was
called Ted Turner.
Ted Turner, yeah. And they ran it week in, week out, you know, Get Carter. So I knew there were supporters, but I wasn't conscious of how tenacious they were, actually, you know.
Was there a time, Mike, when you were, when mentioned of them, because obviously you move on with your career, you move on to direct other films, you have a very eclectic filmography. So was there a point when, I don't know, when Get Carter starts to bloom again, was there a point where you almost became tired of the film and sick of the film, even in a way?
I don't think it's kind of curious. First of all, you accept that the film is a good film. I think it got, you know, I think certain surveys, you know, overrated the film. It's in danger of being overrated. Whereas, you know, I like it being overrated. But I think it's, it was voted in, you know, competitor with your magazine, I think, by the best British film ever made. Now, it's a good film. I'm proud of it, but it's not the best film, British film ever made, really. It's a good film.
Mike, take it from me. It's a great film. So where does it sit for you in your filmography? Is it your favorite film of yours?
Yeah, because they're all so different. I mean, I'm glad they're having a retrospective of my films at the moment at the NFT. And I'm glad that certain films have been resurrected by Blu-ray, by Arrow in the main, Arrow. And so films that got lost, like Black Rainbow, which is a really interesting film. I'm very proud of it. And that's now getting reviewed again. So I'm always coming from behind, because after Get Carter, so many of my films like Pulp and The Terminal Man was never shown here. And that's being shown at NFT, and I think it will be on Blu-ray hopefully before I kick the bucket, and it's so everything is sort of fitting into place, because my career was kind of bumpy. It was a bumpy career generally, and I settled down again. And the 80s was pretty tough for me. In the 80s, I had to do various films which I really wouldn't have done normally, but I had to live. And I was never any good at setting up my own projects, ever. I always needed help from somebody. My advice to any filmmaker these days is to get a good producer. I had one in Michael Klinger, and I went to America and I made The Terminal Man, and I was also the producer. And I never found anyone really after that that I could make, apart from Mike Kaplan with Sleep When I'm Dead.
Mm. What was it about Michael Klinger, who obviously produced Get Carter?
Well, Klinger was wonderful. I mean, he'd done Polanski's first two English-speaking films. But once he chose you as director, that was it. You know, he just helped you. He helped you make it. And he never interfered. You know, I mean, he wouldn't make suggestions or anything, but he would always trust the person he'd chosen. Well, in my case, anyway, the person who made the film. And certainly that trust was shown in with Pulp, because this was a crazy off-the-head, crazy film in many ways. And he stood by it. I think it's his favourite film, or was. He's dead now, poor man.
Yeah. Was Pulp something that came about directly as a result of Get Carter? Were you and Michael, both Michaels, Kane and Klinger, were you enjoying working together so much that, because Pulp happens pretty quickly as well after Get Carter. So was this something that you were working on and then?
No, it was, we agreed that we wanted to make another film together.
Yeah.
The three Michaels, so to speak. And Michael Klinger gave me various films, scripts to read, and I didn't like any of them. And I really wanted to go back to writing my own, which I'd done before Carter. I mean, in a sense, they were totally original films like Suspect and Rumour. And I wanted to go back to that territory again. So I said, look, I'll write this script for you. I don't want to be paid, and I don't want anyone to make it unless they like it. So I'll do it if you like it, we'll make it. If you don't like it, okay, fine. So I wrote Pulp. It was originally called The Memoirs of a Ghostwriter, which needless to say is a title, wouldn't survive very long, but it didn't. So it ended up being called Pulp. Both Finger and Michael liked the film, although it's pretty mad, I must say, and were brave enough to do it. And they were brave, I think, to take it on. I was brave to write it, and they were brave to make it.
Especially when the pressure at the time must have been to make something else like Get yes. Carter.
It's always the same. You know, you always, if you have a success, everyone wants you to make the sequel, basically, but in a different form and a different title with a different cast and everything. But they want another Get Carter after Get Carter. And I didn't give them that, I'm afraid.
Well, your masterstroke, of course, with Get Carter, and spoilers, by the way, for anyone who hasn't seen Get Carter, although if you haven't seen Get Carter, why are you listening to this interview? See the film, then come back and listen to the interview, is because you kill Jack Carter at the end of Get Carter. So there you go, sequel avoided.
Right, exactly. That solved that problem. It didn't solve the next one, because everyone wanted to make another film like Get Carter.
Of course.
Maybe I should have stuck to thrillers or crime stories, instead of which I made something which is a satire on crime stories. You know, silly me.
but I like that you didn't, Mike. I like that you bounce around. It's hard to pigeonhole you as a director. It's hard to categorize you. And I know there were periods in your career where things didn't quite work out. You started off directing Omen 2. And that didn't quite work out for you. But again, that was something that was very different to what had gone before.
Yes, it's a mistake on my part.
In what way?
Well, because I don't like horror films, to be honest with you. As soon as I went to LA to work on it, I realized I made a terrible mistake. And I was grateful to leave, to be honest with you. People think I was fired, but I wasn't actually fired. They asked me to operate in a different way, an alien way to me. And I said, no, I can't do that. And they wanted me to list the shots I was going to do in the morning, give it to the first assistant, and that was going to be it. And I couldn't do that. So I left, and I was very happy to leave. I was so happy, I said, I don't want to be paid anything. And they were pleased with that. They loved it. My agent hated me, my bank manager hated me, but they loved me. I've got a letter from the producer saying you're one of the last true gentlemen in the world, or something like that. That shows you what kind of people I was working with.
Oh my God, that's incredible. Because some of your work's still in the finished film, I believe. The stuff with Ian Hendry and Leo McKern. That's you, isn't it?
I don't know. I've only seen Omen 2 twice, I think, maybe.
Okay.
I shot... You can tell the difference between my material that I shot and the director who came and took over. Mm. I was totally different. I was making a different film to the producer and what they wanted. It's a common mistake with films is that the director and the filmmaker often has a totally different picture to the person you're making the film for. And that was the case with Omen.
Yeah.
So it was a mistake on my part. You've got to make, I learned from all of these things, but I learned that you've got to make sure that you're making the same film. And otherwise it's really difficult, I tell you, as I found to my cost.
The last time we spoke for the podcast was for the re-release of Flash Gordon. This time you were on the same page with Dino.
We eventually got on the same page. We didn't start off there, but I don't think. But we did eventually get on the same page. I mean, Dino, with all due respects to him, didn't realise that it had to be slightly comedic. It was not... you know, I was took the film, you know, it was based on a strip cartoon drawn in the 1930s. And it starts off with Dr. Zarkov building a rocket in his greenhouse or his conservatory at the back of his house. You know, and in those days, we hadn't been to the moon. And, you know, but now we had. So you couldn't possibly have a film where you took it too seriously. Let's put it that way. But you had to take it seriously when it came to the, you know, the Saturday morning quick, fast, you know, appeal to the young people, to young people. So I Dino just didn't realize that. And the crew would laugh in the dailies, you know, in the morning. And Dino got very upset. Mike, why they laugh? You know, why they laugh? And I had to ask the crew not to laugh, you know, so because he was slow to realize, seriously, that it had to be. There was no other way of making the film, a tongue in cheek. No other way.
quite right. And I've got to let you go in a second, Mike, but obviously Black Rainbow is something that is close to your heart, but otherwise, should we skip past the 80s for you if it was a bad time for you? Was it just tough in terms of getting projects you wanted to make off the ground?
Well, there was that. I mean, I, you know, but it's also that you know, when I took, you know, when I took on some scripts that I wouldn't normally have done, I was trying to make a good film out of this, out of a rather bad script. Some people would call it a purse out of a sow's ear, but that's difficult, frankly. So, and I didn't fail. I mean, Prayer for the Dying was also re-edited without my permission, and I, you know, it was a tough call for me because I took it on a month before they were meant to start shooting with Mickey Rourke, and they had a deal with Mickey who for, you know, $1 million, I think, whether the film was made or not. And so I did them a big favor by sort of taking, I needed the money and I needed the work. But I also did them a big favor by taking the film on. And then they paid me back by, you know, the film's all right as it stands. It's okay. I don't mean that. But I know what it was like when I finished it. I know the music was different. I know the sounds were different. And, you know, in the main, all the visuals are the same, but it's not the same film, you know. And so I you know, it caused a lot of anxiety in my life because it was about the IRA and certain newspapers, tabloids, said that I was an IRA supporter and that's why the film was, I wanted the ending as I'd had it and had me to, but nobody'd seen the film. So they just made it up. It's just, when I was then getting IRA threats and God knows what, you know, all threat. No, not from the IRA, from you know, other people who were against the IRA.
Yes.
So it was a very uncomfortable period for me.
Oh my word! Well, in that case, let's finish this interview on a high, without recalling death threats and whatnot. Because if people haven't seen Black Rainbow, if you can go and see the season of Mike's films at the NFT, Black Rainbow is a fantastic film. Rosanna Arquette and Jason Robards, really, really great stuff. And then there was a gap between that, between that and Croupier, which I think, and then I'm Asleep and I'm Dead, which is your Clive Owen double whammy, if you will. And Croupier in particular is a fantastic film. And was that something that you look back fondly on, that movie, in terms of returning you to the director's chair and working with Clive?
I mean, resuscitated my career, Croupier. And it started, and not, Clive was a good actor before I ever employed him. Mm-hmm. And he was a star in this country, but, you know, a Croupier made him an international star because the film went through the roof in America. But here, you know, again, I had to stand by the film and make, I mean, the main thing that came through all of my life and career in terms is you've got to make the film that you leave the film in the way that you want it to be made. That's the only crucial thing. What happens to it after that, it's no, you can't control it. Stanley Kubrick could control it, but I wasn't Stanley Kubrick, you know. And I, you know, so you just have to say, that's the film that I made and I'm proud of it and that's it. And you know that, like a message in a bottle, it'll roll up somewhere. And it usually does, you know. Black Rainbow was the way I wanted the film. Mm-hmm. And Croupier again, I had to fight to keep the film that I and Paul Marsbrook, who wrote it, made. And I had no problem with I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, but Croupier didn't look like it was going to get to be distributed in the UK, which meant the end of its life. So again, I repeat, the BFI were, I'm grateful to them.
I'll Sleep When I'm Dead is now your last film. We were talking before I pressed record on the podcast. We were talking about how you are now retired. You're almost 90. But after the film came out, were there other films in the pipeline, or did you?
Yes, there were.
Yeah.
Well, that's making films in this country. You know, I had another beautiful script called The Chinese Busker, which Trevor had written again. And I had another one, which I was making with Mike Kaplan, called Marianne the Magician, based on a Thomas Mann novella. And we couldn't get the money. They're both terrific scripts, but we just couldn't get the money. The British film industry is a curious one, because it's no longer there. When I made Get Carter, there was the studio system was still in operation. Mm. And most of my films were studio films, actually. And although everyone cursed the studio system in those days, I began to miss it terribly. Because you get, once one person makes the decision, then it gets made. You know, that's that. Yeah. But now it's, if you look at the credits of films these days, there's about 20 companies involved. You've got to put this package together, to get this damn thing made. And with Dino, joy of working with Dino, as with Michael Klinger, was you've got decisions. It's one person making a decision. Bob, that's it. And that's joyful when you're a director. You feel secure with that kind of situation.
Because even something like Roy Budd,
yes,
choosing him as a composer feels like something that nowadays you would probably have to jump through a dozen hoops and have a dozen different yeses from a dozen different people that you've never met before that gets approved. But it strikes me that back in 1971, I want this guy, this jazz musician, and they say yes.
No, exactly. It's a much freer situation. And then a lot of people, most of the people who get involved, if you look at the number of producers there are, I mean, these are all people who've got their fingers in the pie. How can you make a film with that kind of, under those circumstances? I mean, I know, a lot of directors must be absolutely hell trying to appease all these people. And most of them bugger all about filmmaking, so which makes it even worse. So it's a curious profession. I'm glad I couldn't make films now, I don't think. I just couldn't do it.
And what do you do these days, Mike? What fills your days if you're not making films?
Oh, well, that's a very good point. I read a lot. I listen to music a lot. I used to play the clarinet, and I used to draw and paint a lot. Mm-hmm. Those have seemed to have dried up now, because I just read.
Nothing.
I'm a voracious reader. That's one my way of escaping now.
Amazing. And listen to music as well. And the last question I'm going to ask you is, do you ever listen to the Get Carter soundtrack? Do you ever stick on Roy Budd just for a bit of pleasure? It's a great soundtrack, Mike.
I got to know, it is a wonderful soundtrack. Roy was terrific. I got to know his widow, Miss French lady. She died with COVID, I think.
Oh.
And so I managed to get jazz record requests on Sunday afternoon, late afternoon now. It used to be Saturday. But anyway, BBC and all their wisdom changed it to Sunday. And I managed to get it, Roy's theme tune played on it, which gave her a thrill. So I was pleased about that.
That is beautiful. A beautiful note on which to end. Mike Hodges, it's been an absolute pleasure. And go see Get Carter. The re-release looks astounding. Thanks so much for your time, Mike.
Thank you, Chris. It was very delightful talking to you. And I mean
you. Oh, bless you, sir. Thank you very much indeed. Likewise. Cheers, Mike. Okay, so that was Mike Hodges. Hope you enjoyed that interview. For more from Mike on Get Carter, I did an in-depth interview with him for Empire Magazine, which you can see in a future issue. For now, though, Get Carter in all its restored glory is playing in selected cinemas across the nation, so if you haven't seen it before, sorry about the spoilers in this interview, do go see it. It is absolutely phenomenal. And if you have seen it before, but you haven't seen it in the cinema, then go see it on a big screen. You're a big screen, but you're in bad shape. With me, it's a full-time job. There you go. Nailed it. Right, I'm off to drink my nighttime Horlicks in a thin glass. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.